The House will come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
You know what that music means. It's time for a new episode of Capital Ideas, the podcast where members of the Majority Democratic Caucus in the Washington State House of Representatives sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. To be clear, they also talk about bills that became law, bills that didn't, the enduring democratic values shared by the people of the Evergreen State, and how things look through their own eyes. That would be too long of a title, so we call it Capital Ideas. Today's conversation is with 47th District Representative Deborah Entenmann. This is Deborah's sixth year in the legislature. She's vice chair of the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Committee and has seats on the Civil Rights and Judiciary, Transportation, and Housing Committees as well. That's a pretty heavy load, and there's a lot we didn't have time to talk about this first time around, so you might think of this as part one. We recorded this on Monday, April 8th, 2024, on location in Kent, Washington, and it went like this. Welcome to Capital Ideas, Representative Deborah Entenmann. It's very good to have you. You're from the 47th Legislative District, and this is our first time to talk on Capital Ideas. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking me to participate in the conversation.
We're going to talk about all kinds of things here, but before we even get started, let me get you to describe the 47th Legislative District.
47th Legislative District is a suburban area. We still have some rural parts of our community, and we have what I would say is people can talk about sprawl. We have limits on growth. We have a large number of folks who unfortunately are homeless or have experienced homelessness. And we also have a number of folks who are using our food banks more often. But we also have people who, you know, have season tickets to the Seahawks and the other professional sports teams, lot of law enforcement and medical professionals we seem to have a large number of folks in our area. Great place for families, really good schools, lots of parks, lots of places to walk and ride your bike. So it's really a nice place to live.
Just about a month ago, the 2024 legislative session wrapped up on time. The 23/24 biennium is over. Can you give me kind of an arc of that legislative biennium? That was your third two-year setup there in Olympia.
Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, when I first came, we didn't have COVID. Second year, we were experiencing COVID, so we had remote testimony, and everything was remote. It was all new, and it was all different. So I think about this year being back full-time, in person, was like our very first year. And so you sort of felt a little bit like a freshman or a sophomore, but not really a junior yet, right? Because that COVID year took us off campus. We didn't have those same relationships with each other, with lobbyists, with the Senate, and with the governor. So it's like coming back, getting to know each other again. It's like we have an extra year. So this year was like an extra year. And I will say that the end of this session, this short session, it was a hard session. We worked really hard. There were some times when people were a little contentious. And that's just the Dems. I'm not even talking about the Republicans. And then, of course, the Republicans had their strategic moves that they were making. So that was all new. All that parliamentary procedure was new to me. So I learned a lot during this legislative session. And overall, I've always enjoyed being a legislator because I'm one of those people who always likes school. And so to me, during a legislative session, it feels like we're back in school.
Well, you've got class all day and you've got to learn new things every day.
That's right. That's right. And I think that is the thing that any of the takeaways, no one knows everything. There's always something to learn. And every legislative session, I learn something new.
Tell me a little bit about your background. I know some things because I have read, but you and I have never sat down and had a long conversation mm-hmm. before. We know each other, but this is going to be the longest time we've talked. So tell okay. me who you are.
Who I am. I came to the legislature. The very first time was about 2003, I think it was. 2003. There was a short session and I was a legislative aide. And I worked for the House Democratic Caucus. Through that work, after I left there, applied for a job working, because, you know, everybody needed work after the session was over. And I started working for Congressman Adam Smith. And I worked for Adam for 12 years. Started out in constituent services and worked my way up to being the district director. The last 3 years I was there. And I, prior to that, was a stay-at-home mom. And I returned to school when my children were, and when I say return to school, I went to Highline Community College. My children were taking some community college classes and they were both in high school. And so I started going to Highline, just taking some classes, thinking that I wanted to go back and finish a degree that I had started 20 years before. And I thought I was going to go into teaching. That was my goal. I come from a family of educators, my mom, my aunt, my uncle, teachers, principals here in Washington State and also in the state of Louisiana. So I thought that was going to be my path. But I got hooked on the issues around education policy, changed my major to political science, and then started on this journey working on policy, legislation, and how to make changes. Originally, if you would have looked at my life when I was a small child, I grew up in Rainier Vista Housing Project in Seattle. I was in the first class of Seattle King County Head Start. And my mom became a teacher because she was a parent volunteer and they encouraged her. They said, oh, we think that you could teach. How would you like to go to school? She had three kids and my grandmother was with us. And so she was like, you know, I don't know how I would do that. She found a way to do it, and she went to Seattle Central College, and then she went up to Bellingham, and Seattle Public Schools at the time was trying to recruit Black women to become teachers, and so my mom wasn't the first, but she was in that cohort of first African-American teachers in Seattle Public Schools in the late 60s, early 70s. And through her work, I just saw that the time that you go to college is when it's your time to go to college. So they didn't call it, they now call it a non-traditional student.
Right.
It was just an older student. I was just an older student. But my mom was an older student. So I had seen that example before. So it was just, you know, something I decided to do. Right now, when I think about being in the legislature, I'm still interested in continuing my education through graduate studies. I'm studying right now to take my LSATs and hopefully will be accepted to law school in the future. So lifelong learning. I'm still interested in going to school and learning and seeing what's available.
Well, good luck. You had a good role model, it sounds like.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I do believe that my mother was an excellent role model.
Just by chance, you happen to be the vice chair of the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Development Committee there in the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of fortuitous.
Well, I'm also a trustee at a community and technical college. I am on the board of trustees at Renton Technical College, and I started that work when I was still working for Congressman Smith. I'm coming to the end of my second term, depending on who our new governor is, and if I decide to reapply, which will really just depend on what my educational goals, where I am in that path. But I have really enjoyed being on the Board of Trustees for a community college. I think that the work that I get to do as the vice chair, the work that I do as a trustee, really informs that work for a lot of us in the state and even members of our committee. Funding for our 2-year colleges is different than funding for our 4-year colleges. There are 34 community and technical colleges. Just by the nature of how many colleges there are, we serve more students. but we serve more students with a greater need. And so we always have to do more with our tuition dollars. And we have to find creative ways to make sure that our students get what they need. I am always concerned about the student who is hungry, student who is homeless, the student just who has those insecurities that make it more difficult to finish school. It's the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Development Committee. We really do want to make sure that students are coming out with a credential of some sort that helps them to go into the workforce so that they can do whatever it is that they want to do, whether they go into an apprenticeship, are just improving their office skills, or they want to transfer to a four-year. We want to be able to make sure that we can do that, and they can do that here in Washington State instead of leaving the state. So all of those are my concerns, but it really has informed me being a trustee, what it's like.
You know, it seems like over the last, let's say 15 years, the role of community and technical colleges has changed massively, at least here in Washington, with the need for more skilled tradespeople and the expense of going to four-year colleges.
Right.
One of the bills that you sponsored has to do with what's called post-secondary student needs. Sounds like a pretty interesting bill. I think it probably got some pushback from the other side, but I believe that it was successful.
It was, and I have to say that I know that the argument on the other side was, we often heard, we ate bologna sandwiches, we ate top ramen. And yes, I remember having those experiences as well, but I didn't live in my car, and I didn't have to have one of my friends allow me to go in their dorm so that I could take a shower. And I didn't have to decide between doing my laundry or buying my books or having something to eat. And these are things that not only are our community college students experiencing, but even some students at our four-year college are experiencing a lack of basic need. I was telling someone, my husband and I had the opportunity to send our children to the colleges of their choice. My daughter went to Emory, and my son went to the University of Washington, Tacoma. And I remember those times when we would make a budget, and they would exceed their budget, and they would call and say, I don't have any more money. And I would say, well, you have a meal card. Use your meal card, right? We joke about that, but we have students who really do not have their basic needs covered. They don't have someone who can send them an extra $200 because they're over budget. They have a very narrow budget, and they have to stick to it because they have made a decision that their goal is to finish college. I think that is one of the most honorable things a person can do to improve their lives, is to get an education so that they can be self-sufficient and self-reliant. And I think that it is the collective responsibility of folks in Washington State to help students who want to do that.
Congratulations on that bill.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that. I think that our students who are at our community and technical colleges can be whatever they want to be. I just would like to give them a hand up so that they can be whatever they want to be without a lot of debt and without having to experience a true crisis. We sometimes have systems that help students when they have gotten into or are experiencing a crisis. I think with the benefit navigator bill that I had the opportunity to pass in this last session, I don't want a student to have to be in crisis. I want people to understand that our students are parents. Our students are taking care of parents. Some of our students are taking care of their siblings. Our student is not always the student who goes right from high school to college. We want to make sure that we are serving all of the students in Washington State, and I think this bill will help us do that.
You're on a few other committees as well. In fact, you're on four committees, which I think might be a little unusual. It's kind of a heavy load. you're on three other policy committees, civil rights and judiciary, housing and transportation. I want to hit on all of those at some point during this conversation, but I want you to be the guide on where we go next.
Okay. Well, I would say that the committee that I feel the most passionate about is civil rights and the judiciary. I had the opportunity to be the sponsor of a bill around police accountability. There are things that are happening to all of the folks in Washington State. We have a responsibility to make sure that our systems are protecting the most vulnerable, and civil rights and the judiciary is a place where we do that. And so it's a very interesting committee because all different issues come before us. We talk about housing, we talk about privacy, it's just a very fascinating committee. And so I really enjoy being on that committee.
The bill you're talking about, I believe, is the bill that created the Office of Independent Investigations. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal.
Yeah, the Office of Independent Investigations allows that when the police use deadly force, we independently investigate what has gone on. What we have found over time is that once the police use force, we sometimes lose sight of why they were on the call in the first place, and they go to why the police use force. When we have this Office of Independent Investigation, we do an investigation of why the police use the force, whereas they can still go and investigate why they were on the call in the first place. We have a state where we very seldom, if ever, will charge a police officer when deadly force is used. We have had a very well-known case, the Manny Ellis case that came out of Tacoma Pierce County. I was happy that we had things in place. I wish we had had more of those things in place with our particular office. I think that the investigation may have been different, and I am of the belief that the outcome would have been different, and that those officers, although charged, which was something that was unusual, I think that they would have been convicted. If we have brought a case that says that Manny Ellis died of homicide, are we now saying that he died of homicide, but it wasn't anyone's fault? Or are we saying it was his fault and not the police officer's fault? It's a very challenging, very difficult, but very important piece of legislation to have independent investigations of what peace officers are doing in our name. And I think the Office of Independent Investigation is one tool in the toolbox. We are still trying for an Office of Independent Prosecution, which I think would lead to closing that gap. But we are still working on that. There are constitutional questions about an independent Office of Prosecution that we are trying to work through. Right now, Representative Stoner has a bill. I still have my bill that didn't pass. Talking to the Office of Independent Investigation, the lead there, we are all still trying to figure out what is our best path forward for an Office of Independent Prosecution. And then I think if we have both of those, we will move closer to justice in our state.
At some point during this conversation, I was going to ask you about your priorities for the 25/26 biennium. I think we've just talked about one of them just now.
Right. I want to make sure that we can work on an Office of Independent Prosecution. Another issue in our state seems to be the number of people who are driving uninsured. So do we want to have a state-funded insurance pool for folks who cannot afford insurance? We have seen a 25% increase across the board in auto insurance for a number of people in our state. That's a record percentage of increase. Everyone's complaining about it. I think we have to understand that part of our car insurance system wasn't as fair as it could have been. So there were some changes that made it more fair for all people. So that meant that the cost got spread across everyone as opposed to a few groups. I think there's still more changes that we can do. I think creating a pool for affordable insurance in our state would get more folks covered, so we could hopefully not have the rates go up 25% in our state. That's something that I'd like to work on. And then I'd also just like to work on something that is near and dear to my heart, which is school meals, kids in elementary school having free lunch, breakfast and lunch at all of our schools.
Representative Richelli had a bill that did pass. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that would dovetail with what you're talking about.
We were very successful with that bill. We just want to cover more kids. It had a limited amount of dollars, so it's not at all schools. I think it should be at all schools. The fact that there is school lunch debt, to me, it just seems fundamentally wrong in America that there is such a thing as school lunch debt, where either students don't get to have lunch at all, or they're simply given a peanut butter or a bologna sandwich and shamed into bringing money to get rid of their debt. I just simply think we should cover school lunch for all kids.
It sounds to me like one of the things that we're talking about here in the last couple of topics has to do with equity, mm-hmm. basic equity in society.
Right.
And this has been a watchword in the House Democratic Caucus for the last few sessions. Mm-hmm. Where are we headed?
We are in a point of determining whether we are going to move forward on this road of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or whether we are going to pause. I really hope that we determine as a caucus that we will move forward. We are now really meeting resistance. People are taking the words and they are deliberately misconstruing them to make it seem like we are taking something from one group of people to give to another group of people. Whereas I see diversity, equity, and inclusion as just simply sharing what we have and making the pie bigger. And I believe with making that pie bigger, it enriches all of us. We learn so much from each other. We learn that we are more alike than we are different. And we lessen the fear of misunderstanding. And those are all things that I think are really important if we are going to maintain our democracy. I think we are at a crossroads. We've been at this crossroads before in the United States. I'm 62 years old, so I have seen a few things. I grew up in the civil rights movement. My mother would help people register to vote. I remember going on marches so that we could have a school bus that took us to school instead of walking along what was then Empire Way, which became Martin Luther King Jr. Way, when I lived in Seattle. I remember being in church when Dr. Ralph David Abernathy was coming to our church and there was a bomb threat and we had to leave our church. That was here in Washington at First AME Church in Seattle. All of those things I experienced as a child. And they made me know that things were unfair, but they could be better. But we had work to do in order to make change. It just wasn't going to happen because good people were going to become better people. You have to have action and intent behind that. So when I look at what people are doing in the legislature, I look at what Speaker Jenkins and leadership is doing in the legislature and all of the members, this is not easy work. This is not easy work. It takes its toll on us emotionally and physically. But it's worthy work, and it's work I hope to continue in the legislature.
One of the areas where this is a key topic is business. Mm-hmm. And to be real specific here, one of the businesses that maybe needs the most correction towards equity has to do with a relatively new business in Washington, which is the cannabis business.
We have a social equity and cannabis bill. I sponsored a House version. And Senator Saldana sponsored a Senate version. We moved her Senate version and it did pass. Originally, when the bill started, we said that there were 47 licenses that were available for social equity and cannabis, which meant that they were available to people who had were in communities that were disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs and other race-based law enforcement initiatives. People lost out on their lives because they were put in jail for selling marijuana. And in what is the, of course, the most ironic thing, it is some of those same places now have legal marijuana shops. But what has happened is because of, I believe, some intentional mismanagement, this is not something I haven't said to other people, in the Liquor and Cannabis Board when it was first created, we had an unfair impact of most of the licenses went to white people in those same communities. Now, when we had medical cannabis, and this was before we had the legalization of recreational cannabis, those licenses were, they had a more diverse group of people. African-American people, Asian people were able to have, to get those licenses. But when we went into the retail business, those folks, for some reason, were not granted retail licenses. I believe, after talking to a number of people, the folks who were in the medical business thought they were grandfathered in to the retail business. They received notification from the LCB that said they did not have to rush to apply for those retail licenses. Because they did not rush to apply for those retail licenses and they were first come, first serve, they were left out. They thought they were grandfathered in and they were not. So now we are trying to make those corrections in the LCB. It is not easy. I know that they have a new director. Being in any business is difficult. Being in the cannabis business is extra difficult. One, because different localities are saying they don't want cannabis in those communities. That's number one. Two, at the federal level, cannabis is still what I believe to be a Schedule I drug, which means that the funds from cannabis, most banks do not want to deal with. So the cannabis businesses are cash only, which then makes them more likely to be robbed. I think that if we partner with the federal level to have it removed as a Schedule I drug, and folks who are running cannabis businesses can legally bank that money, that would take a lot of the risk out of the business. And I think that it would be better for everyone. Whether or not a person uses cannabis, we have decided that it's legal, and so I think we should make it as safe as possible for the business owners and for the community.
I think that's what the voters had in mind 10 years ago when they passed Initiative 502.
I think you are correct. It is very interesting how people have perceptions about cannabis, and it is really hard to get over those misconceptions and preconceptions to talk about what it is and what it does. I believe that you can have irresponsible cannabis use. I believe that we have to be careful about synthetic THC. I believe we need to have rules about that. At the end of the day, we decided that we wanted to have retail cannabis. Let's make it as safe as possible.
I want to switch completely here to something that is very timely, which is you had a town hall 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
How was the town hall for the 47th Legislative District?
You know, our town hall was really nice. People got up, they spoke. It wasn't contentious, although I didn't agree with everything everybody said. Representative Stearns and Senator Kaufman and I were treated with respect. And although we sometimes disagreed with what people said, no one was disagreeable. I think that there are some misconceptions about police accountability and defunding the police. I have never proposed any legislation that would defund the police. I have only proposed legislation that I believe makes law enforcement safer, not only for peace officers, but members of our community. And so we had to talk about that. We also talked about taxes, whether or not they should be raised, how localities can raise taxes through the B&O that doesn't impact everybody. We talked about the fentanyl crisis. We talked about how in our district we do see people on the streets. We want them to be able to get help, but we don't have a lot of services for people who have substance use disorder. And we also talked about people who are mentally ill and we don't have a lot of services for those folks either. So what can we do to work together at the state level and with our cities and counties to put funds in our community so that we can have community crisis center and community resource center for people who are mentally ill and who are on drugs? Not everybody who is mentally ill is taking drugs, but we see a lot of co-occurrence of that happening. I'm not an expert. I have learned that some people are trying to self-medicate because they do have mental illness. Some people with substance use disorder also may have had undiagnosed mental illness. So they are tied together. And I also think that we have homelessness, which I think leads to despair. Again, I'm not a psychologist, but I think for some people, once you become homeless, you are in such a desperate situation that you will do anything to feel better. And I think sometimes people turn to drugs. I'm not saying that all people who are homeless do that, but we do see an increase in that in our homeless population. So if we can keep people in their homes, I think that that is really important. And we talked about that at our town hall. We talked about senior housing. Many seniors in our communities have been living in housing developments that haven't been updated in a number of years. So they're trying to figure out, will they be updated? What kind of investments are made? What were the promises made by the developers? And do they have a responsibility now to come back and upgrade those apartment complexes that are senior complexes? We had a number of seniors, you know, because we've had this record heat, want air conditioning units put into their apartments. And some people were allowed to do that and some people were not. So all of these things impact the community in which I have the honor to serve. And so people were talking about all sorts of things. It was really nice. People did talk about the initiatives. And then people were just talking about more things for kids to do, more things for seniors to do, making it more cost effective. Or how do we encourage families to do things in our community? And how can we do that in a way that it doesn't cost a lot of money?
This sounds like a heck of a town hall.
It was really a nice town hall. I thought even people who were at the town hall were a little bit nervous. They said, we were nervous about coming. We were glad that it wasn't, because, you know, in their minds, and just like, you know, we're all cautious. As elected officials, you have to be cautious. But there were some people who were like, well, I wasn't going to come, but I'm glad I did. I felt comfortable here. Thank you for having a town hall. So overall, whether people agreed with us or not, I think that they felt heard. I think that's really one of the most important things we can do as elected officials is listen to what our constituents are saying. Now, listening doesn't always mean agreeing with them. But when we disagree, explain why we disagree. I think they're for a large number of people. They have a perception of how government works. They were talking about bipartisanship, and we know that in the state legislature, we're about 90% bipartisan on most of the bills we pass. They did not know that. I think they have this idea that we're just down there arguing all the time.
They think it's the other Washington.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think just demystifying who we are as legislators is always important at a town hall.
That's also one of the reasons that this podcast, Capital Ideas, was created 16 years ago, is to demystify and also so that people could get to hear their lawmakers talk about what really goes on in Olympia mm-hmm. and in their districts. And for me, it's always surprising. I learn something every time I talk to a lawmaker.
I learn something from my colleagues who are Democrats and from my colleagues who are Republicans.
Let's talk about another bill that you sponsored that I think a lot of people found very interesting and it didn't pass. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with micro-enterprise home kitchens.
Right. This is a really interesting bill. We have a number of people who make food and sell food around businesses, like for lunch, sandwiches, tamales, different things. And they are usually cooking that food at home, and they are not cooking in a commercial kitchen, and it's illegal. So we have been trying to figure out a way to make it legal. And when some people tried to have their homes qualify so that they could cook in them and have that prepared food sold, the rules were just prohibitive. You almost had to create a commercial kitchen in your home, and most people can't afford to do that. So you're back to that illegal market because they didn't have a place to cook. There are some places now where people share a commercial space. You sort of, from what I understand, you buy shares in a commercial space, or there's a nonprofit that buys the commercial space, and then people use that nonprofit to have their small, because they're making small batches of things. And we do allow some small batch baked goods to be created, but people were doing things like tamales, doing things like sandwiches, and they wanted to be able to do that. And like I said, they wanted to be able to do it legally. So that is what Micro Enterprise Kitchens was all about, allowing you or I to have a certified kitchen in our home that was not a commercial kitchen, that allowed us to follow the rules of the Department of Health, prepare food in our home, and sell that food. We think we might have another way to achieve this goal, because the more and more we talk to the Department of Health, we think that there could be a way to do this so that we don't have this illegal market. If people have come to us and said, we want to do this legally, but some of the rules that are in place are too prohibitive, especially around ventilation. The one woman was saying, I have to basically put in this hood in the kitchen. And I was like, she says, I can't afford to do that. And we also understand cleanliness. I've never met people who want to be in a dirty kitchen to make food to sell to other people so that people can get sick. That's not what people want to do. So we are hopeful that by working with the Department of Health, we can have some rule changes. Keep our fingers crossed. That will allow a pilot program for micro kitchens and then move from there.
Deborah, I would like to be able to talk to you for about another half hour. There's still several issues we haven't been able to touch on, but I've kept you way longer than our appointment today. And so we'll just have to come back and do this again.
We'll have to do this again.
Before we leave, though, you got a couple of minutes here. What do you want people to hear as sort of your last comment before we close out this episode of Capital Ideas?
This is what I want people to hear from me. It is an honor to serve as an elected representative. That's number one. Number two, it is important for people to vote. I'm not telling you how to vote, but really to participate in the process is very, very important. Those voter guides and other things that come to you are important. Please take a look at them. Please turn in your ballots.
That's a pretty good way to end this particular episode. We've been sitting here talking with Representative Deborah Entenmann from the 47th Legislative District. Deborah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. It was an honor.
If you made it this far, you probably know more about Representative Deborah Entenmann than you did, and that's a good thing. Another good thing would be to subscribe to Capital Ideas, and we make it easy. Just navigate to wherever you like to get your podcasts, or drop by the House Democratic Caucus website at housedemocrats.wa.gov and click on the media button at the top. You'll see Capital Ideas in the drop-down menu, and from there it's pretty intuitive. You'll never miss another episode. This is your state government, and what happens here matters. This is a good place to meet the people who are working for you and to learn more about what they're doing. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since November 11th, 1889. Thank you for listening.